As I began, I feel the need to offer this disclaimer. I used it for Easter as well about language. I'm going to talk a fair amount in the sermon about light and our decision and our need to go for light. But often in our world, and especially in this culture, we use the word light as good and dark as bad, and that has some cultural problems. And so I want to be aware that I am hoping to avoid that. I don't think there is something bad about the dark, even though I am talking today about fireflies and reaching for the moon and going for the light. But I'm aware, really aware, of how often those words can hurt. We are in a cultural change right now, especially as we watch television and as we experience books and press and movies. It used to be that we would want to watch television and see the idealized life, whatever we thought it should be like. But the zeitgeist right now is slightly different as we look for the anti-hero. How many of you, no judgments, because I'm one of them, how many of you were fans of Dexter? Breaking Bad? Mad Men? What other type shows things do we look for the anti-hero? Do you have any experiences of reading books looking for someone who's not perfect but is the main character and you root for them? Do you have any of those? What are some ideas?
Real Housewives.
Real Housewives? Love it. Well done. Sterling? I think many of the shows or the books we experience really aim to find this bit of reality, even if some of it's canned, I think. Scandal is another one that I'm a fan of. You can tell I've got some cheap taste in TV. But there's a sense of we like to see people's imperfection, and this is different than I think it used to be. It's hard when we think about our heroes and wonder what kind of people they are. This was often used to relegate them, try to take them out of history. Think about civil rights heroes and particularly Martin Luther King. There was a time in which the government, the federal government, would use things they had learned against him, adultery, proposed ties to people, to see if he would pull back from his ministry and from his efforts in social justice, recognizing he was just a man who made mistakes. Recently, the UUA asked me to write just a brief paragraph of how I, as a minister who doesn't identify as a Christian, how I see Jesus. What's my view on Jesus? And this is in part what I wrote. I wrote, it was in my deification of Jesus that I could reconnect with his story. I traded Messiah for mentor, and I'm glad to have that back. I love Mad Men, and honestly, I can find some connection with Don Draper, though not so much, you know, in the bar in my office and the sleeping around, but some connection that he sees this world as he wants it to be. He traffics in ideas more so than in things, and he wants so desperately a world that he creates, not the world he was born into. The person who created the show, Matt Weiner, is a talented writer and author. He was featured in a book about mentorship, Getting There, and it was written by Jillian Zoe Siegel. So, you know, what are your thoughts about this? And you talked about how hard it was to get this phenomenal show, award-winning, great reviews, on the air. There are a couple pieces, but first he says, Matt says, the greatest regret that I have is that early in my career, I showed myself such cruelty for not having accomplished anything significant. I spent so much time trying to write, but I was paralyzed by how behind I felt. He said, if I had just kept going a couple pages at a time, I'd be at 500 pages by now, but I kept thinking I had to do it all at once. How often that feels true for us. So then I liked another story he told, and I don't know the poem, you all may. He says, I remember studying Samuel Taylor Coleridge's poem, Kubla Khan. Does anyone know that? I'm not familiar. Hey, there we go. That was a great hand. All right, Andy. So according to Coleridge, upon waking up from a deep opium-induced reverie, he recalled a vision and immediately wrote the 54 famous lines. But, this is Matt Weiner writing, when we started doing the poetic analysis, it became clear that there was no way this poem came out all at once. It has this amazing structure. We learned from letters and notes that it had been discovered that it was likely Coleridge not only worked on Kubla Khan for several months, but he also sent it to friends for feedback. Weiner ends by saying, "Artists frequently hide the steps that lead to their masterpieces. They want their work and their career to be shrouded in the mystery that it all came out at once. It's called hiding the brushstrokes, and those who do it are doing it a service to people who admire their work and seek to emulate them." And that is why every week for the past 5 years, I've gone back to the sermon entitled On Catching Fireflies, and I read the words that David Bumbaugh seemed to preach to probably only me. Who else could care that much about fireflies? But I did. He offered this sermon and helped me begin my ministry by being willing to come down off the pedestal and share the heartbreaks and heartaches of not reaching the goal that he longed for and worked for 50 years. And then to hear the message there, to hear him talk about that it's not the goal, it's not about reaching the promised land per se, even though we want to, but about keeping hope alive and ever trying, to hear that was a godsend. His words remain a yoke upon my neck, an ever-present calling forth of what life can be like, similar, in fact, to the stole I wear. It was just a week after he preached the Firefly sermon, and without my knowing it would happen, I came to Fairfax, and I was gifted this vestment. They opened it up, they showed it to me, and I was shocked to see this. It's delightful and it's beautiful. And when someone reached in and turned it on with the Christmas lights and it lit up, I thought, "What are you smoking?" It's a mixed blessing, of course. It's joyous and it's beautiful and it's fun and it's playful. And yet stoles, this thing around my neck, this thing ministers wear, are not only accessories, though I use them to help paint a visual image of the spiritual lesson of the day. These are, in fact, meant as a reminder of the yoke of ministry, that the work is heavy and weighs on us. And I joke, actually, I don't wear this one often, but I joke that there's a battery pack here that lights up the Christmas lights, and I've never changed the batteries because I don't use this that often. But I find that Fairfax probably did it on purpose. My mentor, Mary Catherine, was smart. I think she did it on purpose because it always ends up askew. Like, I'm always imperfect. And each Sunday, I'd be somewhere, and someone would come say, "Let me fix you, dear. Let me get you back." And I'd say, "That's just going to change." It's just the lesson. The title of I Spy a Firefly wasn't really meant to be silly or joyful. When Anise and I were talking, she was like, "Well, I'm trying to find something, but we're going to do this Russian humming piece." And I said, "That's perfect, because the sermon I have isn't about joy per se, but about risk and failure and disappointment and how to go forward." I recognize that there aren't fireflies floating around us literally, but for me, the sermon was useful to say that I saw potential in my life, potential in the world, potential in the life and ministry of Bull Run UU. It's a suggestion to all of us that we might look at our lives and the world around us and see what we might be dreaming and what we might chase, even if we can't get all of what we want. The light of fireflies shine ever so briefly, and they move around so fast, you know from being a kid, that it's hard to catch them in time. But if we're ready and willing to jump and leap, we might catch something special, but we might not. Buddhist writer Jack Kornfield writes that instead of clinging to an inflated superhuman view of perfection, we must learn to allow ourselves the space of kindness. There is a beauty in the ordinary. We invite the heart to sit on the front porch and experience from a place of rest the inevitable comings and goings of emotions and events, the struggles and successes of the world. Think about that for a moment. Can you sit on the front porch of your heart? take in the comings and the goings, the struggles and the successes? Do any of us really reach the moon the way we think we might? In addition to David's sermon on catching fireflies, there are a few sermons that I hold on to. Like you, I hear plenty. Few stick out forever. One of the first UU sermons I heard was based on another text. The Reverend Angie Tyson used a song from Don Henley and the Eagles. You know, we're really getting deep here. She pulled out the Eagles and she said this line from the song, "After the thrill is gone, what do you do when your dreams come true and they're not quite what you've planned?" And ever since she said that in the pulpit, I thought, man, I don't know. But they're not. And I think that's okay. I don't know about you, but my life isn't what I planned. And frankly, had it turned out that way, it wouldn't be quite as good because I didn't imagine any of you, nor did I imagine my wife or my child or my friends. I couldn't have. And that's part of what it means to be open to life. Many of us as kids have grand imaginations, but we could never, ever imagine what it's like to come in contact with diverse people, diverse beliefs, diverse understandings of the world and the holy. And so we take it a day at a time, learning and growing, reaching out to one another, and going for our own goals. For me, at least, it was clear that I needed to keep going. So often in life, early on at least, it was easy for me not to reach for the moon. I feel like I got that backwards. I think a lot of kids are good at just, you know, trying stuff and being willing. I wasn't. I'd only apply for something if I thought I'd get it. I wouldn't risk. But later in life, sometime in high school, something happened. I don't remember what it was. Maybe it was a flame that I thought would last. Maybe it was a job I wanted or a project. Something happened, and I noticed that the chance passed by. And I thought to myself, I don't want that to happen again. I don't want to feel regret. I don't know what's coming later in life or what life exists after this. I only have now, so I must take what I have. I don't know if you've had that opportunity, how you feel about regret and chance, but for me, it's actually empowering to think of the opportunities before me. Whether it's fate or chance, whether it's something godlike or holy-like or just happenstance, I know that when I work for something, when I work for good and justice, I can do powerful things, even if it's not quite what I wanted. But I've got to put myself out there. I think this theme is true for many of us. And many of us are all too aware that the very people, many in this room who need hope, are the ones for whom it seems most distant. The times it seems darkest, the times we need it most. During coffee hour, someone said something about seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, and I thought, it's always hard when you're not sure if that's a good light or like the headlights of a car or a train. You want it to be the good light. You want it to be the moon, the stars, but you're not sure. Now, for some of us walking around chasing the moon, grabbing fireflies, it's second nature. We can do it with ease. It's perfect, but it's not true for all of us. For others, it is a risk. It is a risk of their lives, to simply be who they are. To be a young man of color in a world that sees them as dangerous, to be an immigrant in a world that only sees insiders and outsiders, to be someone who's transgender in a world that mocks you and threatens you, to live is a risk. You don't have to run and jump for the moon. To be is a risk. And there are many more communities who don't have to do anything special to take risks. Women, children, the elderly, disabled, many communities, and there are individuals who don't have those identities, but just through relationships and personal situations face the same dilemma. But more often than not, hope was found in unbelievably dire places. The stories of those who have been beaten and bruised by loved ones, of those who are hungry for food and for comfort and solace in an angry and isolated world. There is, and there must be a hope that exists in the daily lives of people waking up and living. To make this world what it ought to be, a world made fair and all her people one, we might get that moon, but we kind of have to let go of that as the goal. We have to build relationships and community, peace and justice by just being ourselves and reaching out. There's so many times that we can be Merlin in this story. Remember the story? Henry Morgan is fed up. He doesn't think he can do it. He wants to go to the new world, and Merlin's like, "You're just a child." I literally had that conversation a couple weeks ago. I met with a colleague, and I said, "You know, do you think this thing is possible?" And this colleague I love, and they kind of gave me this smile. Let me give you a backstory. This person and I went to the same school. We had the same professor. It wasn't David. The professor told us one time, he said, "You know, the way I tell someone I don't like them is I lean back in my chair and I put my hands behind my head and I say, 'You know, the thing I love about you is,' and then I say whatever it is I don't like." To which I said, "Oh, that's what you meant." I don't know if you'd said it, but it was fun. So this colleague said, "You know, Scott, the thing I love about you is you hope. You think it's possible. I don't. I didn't." And it was hard. It was hard in that moment to know what to do. Grow up, give up, keep my head down and my feet on the ground. Should I just keep going and turn into Merlin to grow up or be Henry Morgan? The trouble is that so often for us, we reach out because we have been hurt, our attempts have been foiled, and out of what we imagine to be kindness, we hope to stop others from getting hurt. But there is another form of kindness. There is a kindness that recognizes that nothing is impossible, nothing. That to Unitarian Universalists, fate is not sealed, nothing worth trying truly lies out of reach, and that if you're willing to stretch and possibly fall, you can reach for something special. That's a particular type of kindness, of respecting the worth and dignity that each life has. That's truly recognizing the unique light that lives within each of us. Often the world has beaten that out of us. Question is, can we reclaim it? A lot of Unitarian Universalism is founded on something called process theology, that we do this work together. There's not one truth, it's not from the past, it's just in being. Alfred North Whitehead, founder of that in large part, 20th century philosopher, he says this: "We find the greatest joy not in getting, but in expressing what we are. There are tides in the ocean of life, and what comes in depends on what goes out." I love this. Nature does not give to those who will not spend. Empty your lungs and breathe. Run, climb, work, and laugh. The more you give out, the more you shall receive. Our gladness is not in taking and holding, but in doing, the striving, the building, the living. It is a higher joy to teach than to be taught. It's good to get justice, but better to do it. Fun to have things, but more fun to make them. The happy person, he says, is the one who lives the life of love. Are you living the life of love? Knowing that life is hard, that we stumble more than succeed, are you thankful? Are you willing to keep reaching for the moon, happy with whatever it is you grab, but knowing that we are here to lift you up when you fall? Amen. And blessed be.